You are listening to the Performers and Creators Lab.
I live for putting my hands on my daughter's faces and making sure that they know how valuable they are.
You feel awful inside. You never want to abandon your child, and yet that's what it feels like, just putting your kid down the first time. And that was probably the hardest thing.
I'm a husband and a dad and an actor, and that's okay. You can be all those things, and they inform each other, and it's taken some of the weight off of being in the room because it's not the only thing in my life.
This isn't just another podcast with tips or tricks. This isn't just interviews with great artists. This is about finding the missing pieces that are going to help you make it as an artist. My name is Holly Shaw, best-selling author, hypnotherapist, and creativity coach. And this is the Performers and Creators Lab weekly podcast where we experiment, where we look under the microscope at the secrets behind crafting and performing, how to be highly visible, and we explore those places where you're still hiding so that you can find your edge. You are listening to episode 21, The Daddy Issue. My own dad has been passed away for over 20 years now. He was this wildly creative, sensitive, and sometimes eerily intuitive man. I have this distinct memory of him always working on stuff in the middle of the night. I remember I would wake up to go to the bathroom and I'd see him crouch there in the living room, his face lit up by the light of the TV while he was editing video. Jim Shaw, Charles Shaw, was a passionate first adopter of camcorders, and he started a business videotaping weddings. My sister and I would earn extra money as we would tag along and help him film the wedding and haul cord in exchange for 40 bucks. I've read that it's our fathers who teach us how to be in the world. And my dad taught me to be inquisitive, seize opportunities, and how to bullshit with people. And I feel like he's often present with me and helping me to edit these podcast episodes. So I want to dedicate this episode to two fathers. One, my own father, Jim Shaw, as well as my son's godfather, David Horick. He's helped me with my son over the last 12 years, coaching soccer, teaching my kid about stuff, and basically covering my ass when I had gigs and didn't have a lot of support. So this week we are celebrating dads who are artists with this special episode, The Daddy Issue, featuring five dads who bust the myth that you can't be a great artist and a devoted father. Getting straight to the point, these days there are a lot of fatherless families in the world. Not all dads stick around, and some fathers feel like they can't live their dreams and be a fully present dad at the same time. Now, just to be fair, mothers also do this too. So I know there are a lot of single dads out there who are also raising families all on their own as well. So shout out to the single dads. What was, you know, really endearing to me about creating this episode was getting to connect with these dads who are just, as you'll discover, really great guys. They're there for their families and they're pursuing their professional artistic careers. So in this episode, we'll talk to a dancer, graphic designer, an actor entrepreneur, a painter, a musician, and a filmmaker about the pressures of being the provider, the ways that they've managed to make their auditions, sometimes with their kid tagging along, and make time for songwriting, and how being a father has just changed them. In this episode, The Daddy Issue. Whispered into your ear that I'm not here. And as you rolled over twice, it became clear. I can't stay this way. Hickey has been a working actor for over 20 years. He works primarily in television, and you may have seen him on such shows as NCIS, Ally McBeal, Ghost Whisperer, The Practice, How I Met Your Mother. In 2004, Blair co-created Casting About, which is an online casting and production guide. And in 2009, Casting About was acquired by Breakdown Services. Blair is also a proud husband, a daddy of two beautiful girls, and a diehard Philadelphia Eagles fan. So you and I actually met at when I was teaching the Stage Fright workshop at the Screen Actors Guild.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. And I was so impressed with you because you came up to me afterwards and you introduced yourself. And right away it was like, oh, like that's somebody that, you know, that you introduced yourself, like you complimented me. You were like, great workshop. And I've taught a workshop in this space before too. You know? And it was like you positioned yourself, mm-hmm. but you were very natural and friendly. And I was like, I look forward to talking to that Blair. I'm just curious. If you don't mind me asking, mm-hmm. you don't seem like somebody that would have audition nervousness. Why were you there?
That is such an awesome compliment. Thank you so much. I think that goes to that old Hollywood thing that, you know, this is business based on sincerity. And if you can fake that, you've got it made. I appreciate you saying that. I do. I have at times almost debilitating audition nervousness. I've had full-on panic attacks. You know, I've never left the room, but I've been, you know, flop sweating and shaking. And I think when I first started out, this business was fun. I mean, I did it in high school. I couldn't wait to go to high school because that's where you could do plays. They didn't have plays in middle school. You had to wait till high school. And I counted down the days so I could be a freshman in high school just so I could audition for the plays. And it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. And I was a theater major in college and you know, stayed up all night doing the shows with all my friends. I went to New York and that was kind of new and exciting. And then somewhere here in LA, I think it started to become serious and I started to have health insurance to think about and I started to have a family to think about. And the jobs were a little bit bigger, so they were maybe fewer and further between. And I lost the fun somewhere. It got too important and it got tough. It got really, really tough. And so I started digging into like, okay, I need to address this. And that's when I saw the notice for your workshop. I thought, ooh, this I need to do. Yeah, I've got two beautiful daughters. One just turned 9 and one is 2.5.
Wow. So still little kids.
I'm exhausted.
So how has this affected your life as an artist?
Well, interesting. I mean, I think it sets priorities differently. That's for sure. And I think this might tie into some of the process I've been going through and the journey I've been going on about not getting, you know, dealing with my own nerves and the panic attacks, which was this job is so important. I have to get this job. I have to please this casting director. If I don't, I'm a huge failure and, you know, I should quit forever. Mm. Having kids helps put things in perspective, you know, being home with them or some of the issues that Alex is dealing with at school or, you know, Charlotte and potty training and all those things that are, you know, going on at home. There are times where I haven't had time as much time to prepare for an audition. I just can't, you know, and that's, I got to be okay with that. The job has become, I've been able to kind of put things more in perspective and say, no, I'm going to give it my best, you know, but it's not the only thing I'm doing today. And there's some other, I got to be at the school and then I'm going to go to this audition and then I got to get home for dinner and that's okay. And that's as it should be. So that's helped, I think. And even just talking to my older daughter about what I do, you know, as an actor, because she's going to go right to, ooh, are you on TV? And, you know, when are you going to be on TV next? And having to explain to her that, well, no, it doesn't always work that way. And there may be long periods of time when I'm not. And trying to get her to understand what an audition is and why I'm not just on TV all the time. Mm-hmm. And explaining, well, no, there's lots of different people out there telling lots of different stories. And I go and I do my version and maybe they pick me or maybe they pick somebody else and that's okay. And And that's funny, that language I didn't do it on purpose, but that's kind of came out one time. So usually that's what I get now when I come home from audition. She's like, so, Daddy, did they pick you?
So, well, oh.
That's, you know, well, I don't know. I don't know, sweetie. We'll wait and see.
Interesting, yeah, that she's picked up on that.
Yes, yes.
That dynamic, even if it's you're trying to get out of that dynamic.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But it's helped, you know, and then I think it's just helped put things in perspective a little bit, you know, and especially the times when I have to, wheel the stroller into the room because I've got Charlotte that day and the babysitter didn't work out and she's coming in the room with me because I have no choice.
Wow. And what's the response that you get when you do that?
Well, it's only happened a couple of times and I will only do it in certain situations. If it's a first call for a commercial, usually there's a little more wiggle room and they're okay with it. If it's callback, if I'm dealing with a network show, I think it's a little less appropriate, especially if I'm reading with another actor. I'm not going to do that to another actor. It's too distracting. But if it's just me in the room for like a first call for a commercial, I'll wheel her in. I'll say to the camera operator, hey, hope you don't mind. I brought my coach with me. I had no choice. And usually there's a little laugh and Charlotte gets her raisins in the corner and watches Daddy and has been a saint so far, knock on something. I'm not the only one actually in this town. It's funny. There might be even another stroller in the lobby, you know, another mom, another dad. A lot of times we help each other out. Some of the older actors I see a lot at, who are kind of just out of the baby phase. You know, I'll come wheeling with my stroller and I watch them laugh and go, oh, I remember those days. You know,
and then you're like, great. So you can watch them while I go in the room.
It's funny. My mom talks about, you know, when she comes to visit and talks about how involved I am, you know, in my kids' lives and how great it is. And it was different than her experience, different than her father. And I think even different than like my dad involved in my life. He was working all the time. We hardly, you know, didn't see him much. And when I was younger and it's something I take for granted. I have the flexibility, thank goodness, that I can do that. You know, it's a definite blessing. So I sort of take it for granted, but I think dads are involved in their kids' lives more these days, perhaps. And I think especially dads with flexible schedules, you know, there are other actors I know who just relish that time at home with their kids and they can in between auditions. And it changes how they look at the world. And I think their approach to the art. And there's also, and again, not to stereotype, but, and I've dealt with this a little bit. There is a little bit of that, you know, you're the man, you're the dad, you're supposed to be the breadwinner kind of thing that still floats around out there somewhere. Yeah. And I've got two kids in it. And that affected me with some of the pressures I was dealing with, you know, which is the whole family's on my SAG insurance. And so I can't let that lapse, you know, and I don't want my wife to have to go back to work and the kind of pressures I put myself under that way, which were ultimately, you know, shooting myself in the foot. It's funny. At first it was too important because I only had these limited opportunities and I had to book the job, you know, and I had to get it. And then when I realized, well, this isn't working, I need to change my relationship to what's going on in the room. I really need to do that. Part of that process was like, let me just take a deep breath. Let me think a little bit about what's going on. Let me explore other people out there talking about this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Which thankfully led me to you and do a lot of reading. And maybe right now, I mean, my manager knows I don't say no to stuff, but I'm not pushing as hard for stuff right now because I do have the website, because I do have my family. And because the auditions have been a little further between now, not quite as frequent, I've had a little more time to think and a little more time to breathe and to think about why I'm doing this and who am I as, who do I want to be as an artist and where does this fit into my life? And spend the time when I'm in the park, pushing Charlotte on the swing to think a little bit about, you know, what this means to me or my approach to the world or my approach to this business. Or, you know, I'm a husband and a dad and an actor and that's okay. You can be all those things and they inform each other. And it's taken some of the weight off of being in the room because it's not the only thing in my life anymore.
Turn to pain.
pressure to be the provider of the family can be really tough. But what happens when the traditional roles of mother and father are challenged? Like with my next guest, Damian Alvarez. He and his husband Patrick are new parents, having their son Dorian via surrogacy. Damian is a San Francisco Bay Area flamenco dancer and also runs a side business as a photographer and a graphic designer. Damian performs regularly and teaches flamenco on Saturday mornings at DSG Studios in San Francisco. And I just loved the fact that Damian was so open to sharing the experience of being a new parent and how tough it can be to keep our shit together when we're faced with that tiny, screaming infant.
Won't take away.
So little Dorian is how old?
He just passes 6 months. He's 6.5 months. When he hit 6 months and we had our 6 month pediatrician visit, was I feel like there's this great weight off my shoulder that, oh my God, yes, my kid made it to 6 months. He's not going to die. Woo! All right. Made it to 6 months. All right. If he made it to 6 months, he'll probably make it the rest of his life.
So for some reason in your mind, that was a thing, huh?
Yeah, and I didn't even know I was carrying on to it. But yeah, like when he comes out, they're so small. They seem so fragile. And you're waking up in the middle of the night like, oh my God, is my kid still breathing? All the basic everyday, I assume, nervous Nelly worries that every new parent has, mom or dad, doesn't matter.
He used language like, I'm mom and I'm dad. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for you, like for both of you, do you feel like even though you don't have to live in that paradigm, like that's not that gender paradigm? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be there for any of us, but you know, especially with two men, like that's kind of a blank slate. It's like you get to create it how you want it. Do mm-hmm. you feel like you still sort of assign roles like mom, dad?
I would say yes. I mean, when Dorian cries, who's the first person? Like I said, about 75% of the time or most days, who's the first person who comes to him when he's crying for whatever reason? That's me. And I just associate that role with good mothering, but I also have still currently a lovely, beautiful mother and a wonderful, awesome dad too. Mm-hmm. So those roles for me, just because of my life and how I saw them, are very traditionally defined. But when I use them, those terms on myself and my roles that I play, I just mean the same acts that I received from my parents.
Uh-huh. I see.
I would say the best way to describe it is it's not the role of mother or father. It's more the act of mothering and the act of fathering a child.
Okay.
It's more the act of than necessarily the role name itself.
Uh-huh. And so what would you say, since this is a Father's Day mm-hmm. special episode, what would you say in your mind, what is the role of the father? If the mother is the nurturer, like what does the father do?
Well, the father is also a very good stabilizer for the home. Mm. Offers a lot of good support for everyone in the home involved, which my husband has been wonderful and instrumental in doing. I mean, we have a very good bond. We communicate well with each other. He provides the stable home that we live in, and we work together to make it a very warm home for Dorian and eventually our second son as well.
What's your favorite thing about being a dad?
Seeing my kid smile when he wakes up from his nap and I come in to pick him up and he does this cutest expression like, you're back. I never thought I was going to see you again. Every time he wakes up, that's the reaction that I get. I mean, fists in his mouth and his arms just start flapping about. And it's just the cutest thing. Like, you know,
Is there anything that you feel guilty about?
For as far as being a parent? At this moment, I'd have to say, to answer that fully, you do face your demons in the first 2 weeks when you're stressed out. And there was one night where, thank God the nurses and the doctors all told us, there will be times when you want to throw your child out the window. Don't do this. As long as you can think about doing it, but don't do it. Really learn. The first time you put your child down, when you've gotten to that point where, kid, you're about to go out the window, and you realize that you have the strength and the love to just put your child down and walk away for a minute. Child is screaming his head off, but he'll be fine. You feel awful inside. You never want to abandon your child. And yet that's what it feels like, just putting your kid down the first time. And that was probably the hardest thing. But also I learned from it that my kid is going to be safe for me. I will never be one of those parents that goes off the wall and throws him out the window, because I had that very first experience and I was able to just face that. I was able to face my kid and say, kid, I love you enough to put you down and walk away and not do anything else.
I want to acknowledge you for that's a pretty vulnerable thing to share. And yet I feel like it's so universal. You know, those mm-hmm. first few weeks are so hard. It's like no one can tell you how hard that's going to be, and that, you know, how crazy you feel inside and how mm-hmm. much.
How emotional, how exhausted, how
yeah. drained.
And it's really tough. And you think some horrible thoughts about your kid.
Mm-hmm.
You really do. And that's, so when you said, is there anything I regret or feel guilty about? They're just the bad thoughts that I think every honest parent has about their kid at some point.
Moving through the day, my mind is somewhere else. The missing puzzle piece is tearing at my heart.
So the music that you're listening to in this episode is from the band Bourbon Therapy. And coming up next, I'll be sharing my conversation with the band leader of Bourbon Therapy, Aaron Skiles. Not to mention, I'm going to talk with the painter who recreated all of the Frida Kahlo paintings featured in that movie. Remember that movie Frida with Salma Hayek? Yeah, Dionisio Ceballos is his name, and we're going to be talking with him and more. All still yet to come in the Daddy Issue. Like you heard me say earlier, having a bio is important, and yet there are so many crappy ones. But having an artist bio is one of the very basic things that you must do. And so I'm giving away something that I used to include in my paid courses, which is a Build Your You Are the Bomb bio mini course. It includes video and worksheets to help you build and write your bio, and also examples of great bios. And truth be told, writing your bio isn't something that you do once and then you're done forever. It's a skill you're going to need for the rest of your life, because you aren't going to want the same bio for your website as you'll need for a program or for writing a grant or a press release. Bios depend on who is reading them, and they need to be different lengths and include different things, right? Well, I explain all of that in my Build Your You Are the Bomb bio mini course, and I give you the tools to continue writing effective, great bios for the rest of your life so that audiences can understand who you are and why they should care in just the first few sentences. I used to actually teach and charge for this information, and now I'm giving it away for free. So go to performersandcreatorslab.com/podcast gifts to pick up your You Are the Bomb bio mini course. Again, that's performersandcreatorslab.com/podcast gifts. You are listening to the Performers and Creators Lab with me, Holly Shaw. call and leave me a voicemail at 415-870-7064. Again, that's 415-870-7064. Or you can find out more about us on the web at performersandcreatorslab.com. Bourbon Therapy is an indie rock alternative country band based in Oakland, California, fronted by the husband and wife duo of Aaron and Rebecca Skiles. And you've been listening to music from Bourbon Therapy's latest album, Hymnals and Hangovers. So I caught up with dad and frontman Aaron Skiles to talk about fatherhood and find out how he makes time to write all these songs and be creative with two little kids, and what it's like to be in a band with his wife, Rebecca.
So how do you find the time to, so you have more than one child?
We have two kids.
Two kids.
Yep. They're 8 and 12.
Okay. And so you've been writing music. You've been in the band together since they were.
Yes. Well, I guess we've really been doing this since 13. So we're going on 5 years. So yeah, they were young.
How does that work? How does that work for you?
Well, it's tricky. I think having my wife in it is helpful now because, while I'm still the primary songwriter, she will give me some input, but also she's okay with me kind of carving some time out. So, you know, I've got a studio that we have that we share with some other bands, and we've got, you know, a couple nights a week. And as a band, we're not there all of those nights by any means. But often after dinner, you know, now the kids are older, so bedtime isn't necessarily right after dinner. But, you know, after dinner, I may leave and go down there if I need to play with some volume, sometimes I need to, you know, crank the guitars a little bit and actually play with some volume, or just in the house. We do have a really musical house. Both my kids play instruments as well. The little one plays piano, and our older kid plays guitar. And I keep them out on purpose on stands because I want to sort of just encourage that we pick them up when we feel the need. And the kids know now, so like there will be times. Like I said, sometimes. This doesn't happen often, but sometimes a song will come to me in like 10 minutes just because all of a sudden I got something and I maybe already had a lyrical idea that I wanted to work on. Mm-hmm. and it matches. And I will be like, hold on, don't talk. I got to go get my notebook. And I run and grab my notebook and try to jot it down. But what I find is that, you know, I don't have the ability to say like, okay, from 5 to 7 is my songwriting time. Like I'm a pretty disciplined guy, and that's how I fit a lot of things in my life, but I can't, as much as I would love to do that. I just can't carve it out. Number one, number two, it's a creative process and I don't work that way. You know, sometimes when I do sit down saying, hey, I've got this idea and I've got an hour before everybody comes home, I really want to finish it. It's just, I can't sometimes, and I just need to put it down. So I basically, you know, I leave the instruments out. I pick them up. I do a bunch of voice memo recordings when I have a little idea. And then if I've got a long commute or if I'm, you know, got some downtime or whatnot, I'll just listen to things or I'll flip through my notebook and just see. Sometimes I just write down song titles that maybe are provocative or, you know, just have an idea to them. Sometimes it's a, you know, I've got a verse or something and I just start to see what comes together. But then every once in a while I have to do like one of these sessions where I'll go to the studio on a Friday or a Saturday where I don't, you know, have obligations the next day, and I'll stay until sunrise, and I'll just, if I'm really feeling it, and I've only done that a couple of times, but that's how I've got the bulk of my albums done is I just do one of these sessions where I just feel very inspired and I get things done. But having my wife who understands that this is my process and she's also, you know, a part of it and wants me to succeed and do this, helps a lot.
Now, does she do the same thing? Like, does she get creative ideas and say, all right, you make dinner, you put the kids to bed, I got this song. The whole house.
You know, it's not really as much of the songwriting is not as much of a passion for her.
Okay.
But number one, I want to say I help a lot as much as I can. So it's not like I go wait till, you know, we're done with dinner and the dishes need to be cleared and then I run off to write a song. Cause she would kill me if I try to make it sound like that, but she works more as, an editor for me. So especially with lyrics, she's a really good writer. I'm not, I get inspired sometimes and I can put some pretty good stuff down, but it's a struggle. And a lot of times when it's time to go produce something, the last step is that I need her to take my framework and sort of revamp it. And sometimes with the melodies as well, she'll kind of help modify those.
I love that you guys kind of work together. Like you fit, your creative process fits together. That's really cool. It sounds like you have a pretty balanced approach. Like you're really involved with your family. But I know that there are a lot of dads that really struggle, you know, finding that time for themselves or feeling like they can take it. It's great nowadays, more and more dads are involved. But at the same time, there are still dads out there now that are now as a result of being involved, being like, oh, but can I have this thing for myself? Is that okay? So what would you tell them as far as, you know, how do you manage that? How do you manage the balance? How would you encourage them?
I mean, it's really tricky. And the very first thing that I will acknowledge is that I am so lucky to have the wife that I have, because she's an incredible partner and she really kind of holds everything together. And she's just kind of the center of our family. So number one, I have that, you know, and so she has my back. But number two, you know, I remember when my son was born, when I first became a dad, that my dad said to me that, hey, you know, it's going to be busy, it's going to be tough, but you need to make sure you still have to take care of you, because if you don't take care of you, you won't be as effective taking care of your family. And that's something that I really take to heart. In fact, literally the day he was born, I think I went like more than 24 hours without eating and I almost passed out at the end, and I realized like I wasn't even paying any attention to myself, and that was sort of like the lesson. But I take that to heart in the sense that like I need to make sure that you know, mentally and physically I am making sure that I do take care of myself, because that allows me to take care of my family as well.
Was there ever a time that something happened or you did something that you kind of regretted, or that was like a wake-up call in either direction?
Well, you know, I guess the one thing that in this whole process of us having started this band about, or at least the journey of the band about 5 years ago, the one regret I had is like, why didn't I do this sooner? And I remember having that conversation with my wife when we were first putting out the first album, and she said, well, you've been involved in music, but you know, she said, listen to these songs, listen to the stories that you're telling. You couldn't have written this stuff sooner. It's not the context from which you wrote, and you know, and the content that you came up with needed 40 years to incubate.
Yeah. Wise lady. I like her. Dionisio Ceballos is an Emmy Award-winning multidisciplinary artist known for his murals and luminous, colorful, abstract work, and has received several awards and grants for his creativity, working in different locations around the U.S. and Mexico, exhibiting his work at the SF MoMA Artist Gallery. And one of the most notable events of his career happened early on when he was commissioned to recreate Frida Kahlo's paintings for use in the film Frida with Salma Hayek.
But speaking of great artists, you recreated Frida Kahlo's work for the movie Frida with Salma Hayek and Alfred Molina.
Mm-hmm.
like, what must have it had been like to do that? I mean, how was that experience for you?
I loved it. And it was challenging at the same time for many reasons. The director of the film, Julie Taymor, who's the director of The Lion King and many other great films. And she also is an artist herself, even though she was a director of the film. So the challenge was that her standards were so high and it was too close, and it made the relationship very challenging. I had a lot of pressure. And then there's also the thing of painting and then having big personalities behind your shoulders. Sometimes, like Salma Hayek, we need the painting in half an hour and I don't like what you're doing here. And like, so there, it was, the growth had to do more with learning how to handle, you know, somebody like Salma Hayek or Julie Taymor and not feel diminished and not feel insecure, and actually my capacity as an artist.
Dionisio's current passion is for mural painting, creating something that lives with people and becomes part of a city. So much so that he even felt moved to get involved in the presidential election of 2016.
So when Bernie was, when the primaries were happening, it was the first time I felt strong resonance for a politician, really ever in my life. I was like, I want to help this guy succeed in whatever capacity. And as an artist, I got to do a mural for him. So I created a campaign to raise some money, because it's like, I'm going to need money to support this thing for paint and for my time. Can I just like take off? So I did some t-shirts. I did a design of Bernie, and then I put some t-shirts out to sell, and then I collect some money and met people in the LA community that were Bernie supporters. And I found it's an amazing wall in a really prime place in LA, in Wilshire and Fairfax, a few blocks from the LACMA Museum. It happened, I painted it, and you know, it got in the papers and it was part of in the media. And then the city wanted it once Bernie did not want, and nor Hillary, and then Trump administration came. The city wanted us to take it down, and we went into trial and we won. And so it's like legally the mural is there.
Was there ever consideration as a father and an artist and somebody who doesn't have to identify with either of those things necessarily, but was there ever a point where you thought, man, I should do something else to be the breadwinner of the family? Or did that ever play in your mind?
Yes. It played mostly in the financial aspect of, like, with the money that I'm making as an artist, we're pretty tight. And it happened several moments in our, you know, she's 18 years old now. And so it played mostly in that edge. It questioned my art, you know, my profession. And I actually applied. The funny thing is I applied for jobs at certain moments. I'm like, you know what? I should just be done with this thing and then be like a bunch of other of my friends who are just going to the office and, you know, paying the bills in a more healthy way, I would say, or you know, more easeful way. It's not healthy. It's just easeful. But it didn't work. Part of me was like, seems like I'm not good at all at other stuff because I'm not getting the jobs. I'm like, you know, I'm getting no and no and no. And so in that way, it has been a... Yeah, definitely a tension of how can I, and there's something about the way that I relate to my art is like, there's a little bit of a spell of like, really, I cannot do something else. It's like, it's not that, and again, I tried, and it's like, my passion seems to be in this area. And if I'm not following that, it shows up because I'm not being successful at other things that I'm trying.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like, so if anything, you know, like, so, and I also think, you know, that I feel like the positive side of these is that I gave my daughter the message of like, do what you love, follow your, you know, your dream. My dream was to be in the arts, whether a little bit as a filmmaker and as an artist. I pursued more as an artist in a certain moment, painter, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because both are artists. But I'm like, that's really what if I taught her something, is that it's like, follow what you want to do, because it's like, it's not about, otherwise you're gonna, you might fail either way, so you better fail it if you are trying for what you want.
Started to rain, it soaked the ground, but still the well is dry.
Hey, all you performers and creators in Ireland, China, Sweden, Costa Rica, all over the world listening, all over the U.S., Nashville, Chicago, New York, L.A., San Francisco. Hey, did you know that there are videos of some of these podcast episodes? Yeah, so I take videos when I interview people, and oftentimes they let me use them for my exclusive video library. It's great because you get to hear stories and pieces of the conversation that I'm not able to include. So you can find this video library at the performersandcreatorslab.com website. And on the menu tab, you'll see interviews with artists. And all you have to do is sign up and you get them totally free. There's not much to it other than then you get access to these great stories that you can't find anywhere else. So go ahead and check that out, the interviews with artists on performersandcreatorslab.com. And we're back with the daddy issue, talking to some amazing dads who bust the myth that you can't be a professional artist and a devoted father. And my next guest, you're going to love his energy. I got to devote an entire episode to this guy. Actually, I would like to do that with all the dads in this episode. There's so many great bits of them that you don't get to hear about. But Tony Gapastione is next, and he's an actor who became a filmmaker. After working in the Bay Area for 20 years as an actor represented by Marla Del Talent, he realized he wanted to make his own work instead of just waiting around for someone else to cast him. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, nobody likes waiting around to be cast. So he started writing, directing, and producing his own film projects. But realizing he needed more support and collaboration to keep going, he started a meetup for artists of all kinds to share work and provide affirmation. And that's called the Creative Crew, who meet once a month. And it's an amazing group of creatives who learn from each other and find inspiration to continue making their own projects by collaborating together.
The whole reason I started what I do on a monthly basis called Creative Crew was sort of birthed out of that discontentment I had to want to make things. So I got some friends together. I said, hey, let's all get together. Let's talk about what we want to make, what we're passionate about, and see if we can all partner with one another. We started meeting once a month together, and that just became this thing that's now still going 6 years later. And we've all, through that, made films together and spun out and helped each other's dreams come true.
How many films have you made since then?
I probably made a ton of crappy ones, that's for sure. But the ones that I'm proud of, probably 4 or 5 real good short films.
Still, that's since 2012.
Yeah.
If you looked at all those and all those stories that you have told, what is there any underlying theme or thing that binds them all together that you could point to? Like, is there a type of story that you seem that you keep telling again and again?
I would say there's probably these underlying themes of questions. You know, I think every film sort of has a question. Do you see me? Do I bring anything to the world that's going to make a difference? You know, in my neighbor film, the idea that human trafficking is happening in suburbia. So will anybody stand up for justice, or will we just ignore this? The film that I just finished writing is called The Thorns We Live With. And it's a story about a wealthy landscaping family that reluctantly reunites because their mother brings them back on Thanksgiving, as you know, their adult children coming back to connect with their aging mother. and she overdoses over Thanksgiving, and they have to deal with the aftermath of that. And the question is, can my pain ever be resolved? Will I ever be a whole person? You know? So I think every story that I'm really curious about has these questions that maybe don't always get answered, but I want to peel it back a little bit and go, doesn't every human being have these wonderings about their life, about their identity, about who they are? Yeah. Will they ever be able to heal? Mm-hmm. You know, like the film 33 Days is a true story about Roger Huang, who founded the City Impact in the Tenderloin. And you know, the question there is, you know, here's a Taiwanese immigrant who came for the American dream, but gave it all up to help the poor of the tenant, the poor and marginalized. And the question there is, you know, can I make any change? Am I significant? Can one little immigrant Taiwanese guy make a difference in the politics of San Francisco? For his story, the question is, yeah.
The answer is yes. I love that. So shifting gears, you're a husband and a father of three girls.
Yeah, pray for me.
So do you think that influences the way that you treat women on your sets? I mean, we've been talking about this on a lot of my episodes.
Yeah.
How Hollywood, you know, what is the way forward? And honestly, Tony, after talking with you, I'm excited to say Tony is the way forward.
Cool. I'll take that.
So, but asking you a question, how does that affect how you treat women? Do you think it's changed or?
Oh, for sure. I mean, and it's sad to have to admit that becoming a father of daughters did that. I mean, I would like to say before I was a father of daughters, I mean, even, you know, how I treat my wife or how I treat women in general, because I value people. I never understood what it meant to be a feminist. I was kind of scared of that term. Honestly, I thought it was like angry feminine people. I didn't know what that term meant at all in the past. And I was sort of rage against that word, like, you know, like, can't we just treat other people equally? But then when I started to listen to women and hear their stories, oh my gosh, now I understand. And then you see like, wow, women aren't getting paid the same. Like, that's just crazy. But as I started to have my daughters and become father to these little girls, I would start to notice the way that my girls were treated differently and the way people even treated me differently having girls. People would say things like, you know, when are you going to get your boy? And I know that people say the same things to all boy families, but it's said in a different way when people say, when are you going to have your boy? Because what I hear is girls aren't enough. And also your name isn't going to go forward. So there was a time when I thought, ooh, that really gripped me. Like, oh my, the Gapastone name is going to die because I don't have sons. And I had to reconcile that. When we found out we were having our third daughter, I cried because I had these lies in my head that I wasn't enough in some way. God is giving me daughters because I'm not enough. My legacy, my dynasty isn't enough. But here's another like transcendent moment where I heard from God said, who told me, your life isn't about your empire. Your life isn't about your name. These girls are gifts to you. And I'm entrusting, they belong to me, but I'm entrusting them to you to care for them and teach them their value. Their intrinsic value is equal to any other creation, human creation on earth. And that impacted me. And on the day my daughter was born, or the day we took her home, so the next day, I was taking my wife out. My daughter is in my wife's arms. And the nurse, who's a male nurse, said, You got a girl? Oh, congratulations. I said, yeah, my third one. And he looked at me and said, what is wrong with you? Something's wrong with you, man. I said, oh no, you don't get to say that to me. Nothing is wrong with me. This child is a gift. And that's when I knew, oh, we live in a whacked up culture that devalues girls and women. And so I live for putting my hands on my daughter's faces and making sure that they know how valuable they are. They know, like, they're 7, 9, and 11. They know that the world is going to try to devalue them and not pay them as much as men. They know that they're going to be objectified because I'm clearly communicating to this, that this is the reality that we live in. And I'm going to do my best to fight for you, but I also want you to fight for yourself. So it does affect the way I treat people on set and in general, in the world. I just want women to know, hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I missed it, that we miss it. But teach us, tell me, I want to help. I want to be an ally. I want to get rid of the Me Too story so that they don't ever have to happen to my daughters or any other woman. Take some time to see that I am not the same as I-
Well, there you go. Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. I hope you enjoyed this daddy issue and these profiles of artist dads. You can find out more about Tony Gapastione's group at The Creative Crew at creativecrewrwc.com. You can find out more about painter Dionisio Ceballos at dionisio.com.mx. Flamenco dancer Damian Alvarez can be found at damianalvarezflamenco.com. And if you're an actor and you'd like to get ahead by building relationships with casting directors and producers, check out actor Blair Hickey's company. I'm telling you, it'll be the smartest decision you make, castingabout.com. And of course, if you love the music that you heard in the show, be sure to go to bourbontherapy.com, where you can buy their music or go to a concert and see Aaron and Rebecca Skiles perform live. And I'd like to thank all the awesome people who helped me make this show possible. Composer Dan Cantrell, who creates all my theme music. Think Tank Team, Erica Milligan, Hannah Romanowski, Melanie Myers. Producer Q Fortier, and executive producer Robert Cholino, and the Voice America Network. And last but not least, thank you. Thank you for listening to the Performers and Creators Lab podcast. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And make sure you leave me a review so that you can be entered to win an autographed copy of my book, The Creative Formula. Woo! Lots to thank for, lots to be grateful for. Until next week, this is Holly Shaw.